Arizona under the Manpower Development Training Act. Through that program, they provide pre-employment training to our criteria. We establish the general curriculum for the course, and of course this includes certifications that are necessary for doing our work, certifications in soldering and welding, and basically we are electronically oriented. And as a result of passing, they become eligible for employment here. We put them on our payroll as full-time employees. They're paid, I believe it's 80 cents an hour while they're in training. We put them on at a starting rate of $1.60, and then we upgrade up to, well, our top rate range now is $3.25 per hour. And we move them on up into supervisory position. We already have had two who have progressed from the hourly level to the supervisory salary level, and we have three additional trainees in process. We've also, of course, we have right now five Navajo supervisors out of a total of 12 supervisors on the floor. And as time goes along, we'll be replacing the Anglos with the Navajos.
Yes. That would be the ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Multiple lighting facilities. Mm-hmm. And for example, these test units here, they're quite sophisticated. They're used to check out instruments on aircraft while they're on the ground. We make these for our Fort Worth division. The long line cables are made for the Atlas program for our San Diego division. That's for the deep space probes and so on. And that's a project that we took on here. Actually, it's not much different than the smaller type cables, which are fabricated in this area. The principle is the same, except for being a bigger bulk, a bulkier item. This, as you can see, is quite a complex operation.
Yeah.
It requires understanding of blueprints, and of course, people are taught blueprint reading in this pre-employment training program. We have an on-the-job training that continues after they come here, and that goes on for as long as 78 weeks. Supervisors instruct people right on the job as they're performing work. Our minimum age requirement here, or rather, a minimum age, of course, is established by state law, that's 18 years, but minimum education is 8th grade. Our average education is right at 10. We have quite a number of completed high school. We're dealing with young people. Our median age is 27. These are young people who've been away to boarding schools, who had advanced educational opportunities, and who have lived with the Anglo society, so to speak, at these boarding schools. They have observed the customs and the mannerisms and the way of life, and they accept it. As contrasted possibly to their parents in some cases, who are strongly traditional still.
Mm-hmm.
But these are youngsters who want TVs and want better education and better for the children, a better diet for the home, some of the comforts and conveniences that we're normally accustomed to. So their motivation is pretty well established before they come here. They have certain personal goals that they want to achieve. And of course,
is this 100% Navajo? That is your
employees.
Your employees.
Yes,
your supervisors.
We have 22 non-Navajos out of 230 employees.
Mm-hmm.
All Navajo. We only have one Spanish American, and that's all. The rest are all Navajo. Well, there are a few American Indians of other tribes than Navajo.
Yes.
By intermarriage and so
yes.
on. But the great majority of our people are for full calibration, the latest equipment, and we hire young technicians who have had schooling in electronics. those people.
Right now.
And, well, they have the manual dexterity that makes it less than frustrating.
Yes.
And this is a new country to us, but it seemed to me that the people are more quiet than those that we associate with, and it's a great relief.
I came here from Vandenberg Air Force Base. I was with the San Diego Division on the Atlas program the past 10 or 12 years. At Vandenberg, I was dealing primarily with engineers, and pretty sharp engineers. Fellows were all pretty strong in the field, but they were also quite temperamental.
Yes.
And we just had nothing but conversations, it seemed like, all day long, you know, about personal situations, problems, observations, and so on. And here we get very, very little of this work-related type of problem discussion. Most discussions I have with people are in matters of counseling them, counseling them in matters of personal finance, it might even be a domestic situation, or something that they feel confident in discussing with us that is not directly job-related, but does have an indirect relationship in that their peace of mind is affected by
this.
And they're very, very open and willing to discuss these things.
Must be very gratifying.
Yeah. Yes, it's very satisfying in terms for us to know that we're being accepted. Having had investors, they figure, well, I better terminate because I'll be criticized if I tell them that I'm going home and help my folks with their shearing or shipping cattle or something like this. And these things are, they can't very well be scheduled for a set time. In other words, if people hesitate to come and say, well, I have to go and help my folks with on their ranch or on their farm, livestock. Occasionally, you have someone who knows they'll be gone for 2 weeks and they'll be back in the
So they just get a leave.
In most instances, they don't know, so they just quit and take off.
And then they come back for rehiring.
But then they come back and discuss what the problem was. And if it looks like it's reasonable,
And this building is the powerhouse. There are two turbines and two generators and two boilers. So if one would fail on us, we would be able to use the other one.
I see.
It costs $9 a minute to shut those two carriages down. If they break down during the day, when all the men are on time, it costs $9 a minute. If one carriage goes down, it's $4.50.
Quite many of the Navajo students have attended, and some have put up hospitals. And indirectly, they also are helping the tribe out too.
Do the Navajos mind? I mean, they are glad for these people to establish the schools, even though do they undermine that the Navajos beliefs, the old beliefs that they have had, the traditional beliefs? Maybe that's not a very good question.
In a way, the younger generation are taking more on over to different religions. Denominations, so forth, but the older Navajos are still with the old tradition, and it's right in between.
That's
like all civilizations in that respect. This is a beautiful area.
It is so good. Oh, it's all right, honey. I think I'm
regulates the grazing
for sheep and cattle
for every Navajo stockholder, and they usually lay down the rules as to how far the grazing rights are, the customary use, and so forth. And then over here, in case there's a home site, that's regulated through the advisory committee. That's another committee right under the Navajo Tribal Council. It actually, it has the same power as the Navajo Tribal Council, but yet it has a committee of 18, and they're selected throughout the reservation too. But if something comes up, a big tribal matter, then it's sent to the council. But the advisory committee does have that authority, and they make rules, laws for the tribe, and they regulate the area, land use, and land status.
Just what is your, what are the factors involved in your office? What kind of things do you do?
What we do in my office, our department is called the Design and Development Section of Economic Development Department. And we're concerned with the architectural structure part of buildings and engineering.
I see.
And we develop these projects either by negotiation or by contracts, or we either do it by utilizing the maintenance department or using regular tribal labor forces.
I see.
Of all the projects on reservation and off reservation checkerboard areas and so forth.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that.
The checkerboard area is areas where Navajos are living off reservation. Certain land are allotted out to individuals and families and so forth, and
but
no
are not
problem,
actually reservation.
But the problem here is this: if they develop in these checkerboard areas, say like a home, it's like what's before you here, then they have to pay taxes on them, so they're not developed. They can only use them just for grazing and so forth. But to actually put up a structure, then the tribe would be subject to pay taxes. We these homes here. The first nine houses here are occupied by General Dynamics personnel, and the rest of here are all purchased houses that Navajos are paying for, and they have complete ownership of these houses here, and the rest are being rented out.
Do they own the land, or was that on long lease?
It's on a lease of 25 years. Each home site lease is
subject to renewal, I presume.
Right.
Belong to the people, or
they belong to the people of that particular family, and it's been owned by their parents,
yes,
and ancestors all the way down. And
yes,
they have the grazing rights or the customary use rights for a certain area,
yes,
where they can have their livestock graze.
Kind of an event to be at the Civic Center on the 18th?
No, I don't. I haven't been down there for some time.
No.
They usually have tournaments down there, basketball tournaments, you know, for
yes,
parts of the reservation. They'd have the tournaments down there. I don't know if they already have had them.
Entertainment
center. There's one located to the city. It's a little bigger than this one here. They have one over at Shiprock. So at each of the communities, the bigger communities, they have these large buildings. There's one located that we're still developing one at Kienta. That's about 200 miles northwest of here. We're building one there, and about finished.
I see. this design, like that, which you see at the end, the bottom of a necklace and so forth.
Naja.
How do you spell that?
Maja.
And what does that signify? Anything?
It's a long story. It's the evil, it's to ward off the evil eye in your Muslim tradition and religion. And the this particular symbol was used on the as a talisman or a good luck symbol on both the necklace ornament for the individual and also on the cross tree, the bridle for the horse. And it was it's a Muslim symbol. And when they invaded Spain, they brought along with them. The Spaniards picked it up as a as an ornament when they invaded Mexico. The Mexicans picked it up as, again, an ornament. By this time, it lost its Muslim religious significance. And it's become an ornament on bridles ever since. And then it's been incorporated into personal adornment as well.
Now, I noticed in the museum, they have the snake. And this is a part of their religion, isn't it?
I didn't notice that.
Meaning the stuffed case?
Yes.
The real stuff.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
But of course, and I'm thinking in terms of the Naja head and the Orient language, is there any connection between this and the snake?
That's a Naga. That's a
Naga.
Head.
That's right.
That's in
Naja.
In Thailand and in Burma. And
no, this isn't related to the snake here at all.
Now, when we were talking about that, he also mentioned something. I thought he said it was related to the masks that they wore in ceremonies.
The Naja?
Now wait, and the word Yeviches or something like that. Now what I didn't get it, and that's the reason. What does that mean?
It simply means Ye is God or holy person.
Yes.
Their religion is so different from ours that you can't, religion is not even a good word for it, because their whole concept is different from our basic thought of religion as a way of life, a spiritual way of life to attain a happiness in the next world. And they don't believe in any next world, and they don't really believe that anything, well, that happiness in this world is an end in itself, and it's not to obtain either heaven or hell.
I noticed that so
we use the term religion. Actually, it's philosophy, because there's a lot of medicine. It's a medical, both medicinal and both
philosophical.
Morale, or not? I mean, moral. It's a way of life.
Yes.
But they don't isolate it like we do. Mm-hmm. We put it in its own little cubbyhole for Sunday mornings, and then promptly forget about it, and even are embarrassed sometimes even to talk about it, unless it's Sunday morning. And they don't quite operate that way. And Ye then is simply, probably more than anything else, and again trying to compare it to something in our religion, probably our concept of angel. It's less than a god, of a true sense of their god.
But higher than a mortal.
But then higher than a mortal. And something that could be, in many places, it's immortal, it has no death. But they have their weaknesses and everything, pretty much like the Greek gods. They have their jealousies and their problems, and sometimes they don't get along, and sometimes the god above them even has to set them straight once in a while.
Discipline. Well, I thought that this, I think I got the whole thing wrong, Wilson, because I thought...
I think you're mixing two different terms that he talked about, and maybe when you listen to this, it might be different.
Yes, it could be. Well, I thought that this design was connected with the masks that they wore.
Now they use the jewelry in their dances and that, but if you're thinking the same thing I am, this what they so-called squash blossom, which is actually pomegranate blossom necklace, with this horseshoe type.
That's the horseshoe type.
That's a Naja.
Oh,
All right. Well, I think that takes care of it.
Now, find them wearing it in their ornaments, but it really has no religious significance.
No.
It's,
of course, a lot of places that we've traveled over the world, their personal adornment goes back to a religious
thing, right.
Thing.
And but over the centuries, this becomes lost.
And you
keep the pattern because this is the same design that my mother, my grandmother, and so forth wore, but why, we don't know.
And it doesn't make too much difference.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the thing that I want to particularly talk to you about is the code talkers. And I hardly know what to ask, but I thought if we got into a conversation here, things would come up. But I think we might go back to the question I asked you this morning as to, and you were telling me then in answer that they do, the Indians do retain a feeling of enmity for their old enemies. And
I didn't want to say it for the
wrong person. Ah, yes.
It was interesting to me, because he was along on a trip, but he and I and a rug weaver in Mission in America a couple of years ago went on a 90-day or 3-month tour of Germany. And all during the tour, they're collecting little things that their German hosts had handled, this sort of thing, because my uncle needs some. So they have to use something in the enemy way ceremony. You have to use something that has been a part of the enemy, scalp or piece of clothing, something that he's handled has been a personal belonging. It could be just a little piece of a napkin or something. All these people were collecting little tidbits that had been handled or been the property of Germans, because their uncles wanted them for, my uncle needs it for medicine, for the enemy way chant, this sort of thing. I said, the heck, it's been 20 years. Germans are still enemies. I mean, it still qualifies. They weren't mad at Germans, they thoroughly enjoyed the trip. But the mere fact that they could get something from Germany that had been handled and been the property of a German, this still made it potent back here to be used.
And they just used them in an ordinary way. They didn't have any ceremony or anything.
No.
They got, they just wanted something from
the
enemy.
No, for the enemy way. The enemy way is a ceremony. It's a 3-day ceremony.
Oh.
More commonly called a squad dance, because the last part of the ceremony, the women ask the warrior of their choice to dance. But it's we call it a squad dance. The Navajos call it an enemy way ceremony.
What do they do with these things?
It's simply.
Well, I mean, suppose they have a piece of a napkin or a cup or something. What do they do with it?
Do they hold it or carry it?
No, it's used in part of the ceremony. There are bundles, medicine bundles, and this sort of thing. It would take 3 days pretty much to describe it as it does.
Well, that's enough.
But it's just the idea that, although there's no animosity with the Germans anymore, it's just that they still can qualify religiously as being an enemy.
I see.
And
now,
so it's, and I know the kids are still bringing stuff home now from Vietnam and Korea. Souvenirs were brought home in World War II. It's a trophy, a war trophy.
Yes. Now, I don't know whether I asked you this. I asked somebody, and I got a little information about the ceremonies that they may have after they have been away. I understood. I think it was Lee Cannon. You said that they will go to a sacred mountain and asked to sort of be cleansed of the things.
No. Well, they wouldn't go to a sacred mountain. They would have what's called a blessing way ceremony, which
that's
is a purification.
Yes. Blessing way.
Right. Most of their rites, the closest term that we can come to in English to describe the particular ceremony is way, because it's simply a way of life that's related during the ceremony. So you'll see the term way used. Blessing way, enemy way, night way, mountain way.
I see.
Red ant way.
It's a rite or
right.
Something like that. That's
a,
right. Now, I wonder, did the Navajos have any difficulty in leaving the reservation? Did they have any psychological effects of leaving their way here at Sutton Reservation and going into a strange land?
Well, fantastic. Yeah. A very traumatic experience.
Very traumatic experience. Can you tell me anything about how it affected them or anything?
At that time or now?
Well, either.
It's a world apart. At that time, there probably hadn't been more than 10 Navajos in the entire tribe that had ever been to Gallup or beyond Gallup or Flagstaff. You're talking about a tribe now. All these kids are
go to universities.
Go to universities. They're all over them. My artist boy, the one that just walked out 2.5 years down to the University of Arizona.
Yeah.
The other boy finished high school at Fort Sill. And all of them, you know, it's a soul. Right now, it's at least they know what's ahead of them. In those times, just to get on a train or on an airplane and go to Phoenix was just like us going to the moon, really. It was just a completely, literally going to a different world.
So the boys who did join up really were going through a serious
experience. They were Neil Armstrongs, really. I mean, as far to them, it was the great unknown. And,
now, I understand that they're, from what I have read, that their performance under terrific stress was just tremendous.
Well, see, in a sense, once they got over there and got it out of their system that they were in a brand new world, this living a rugged life and a active life and a dangerous life.
Is there their way
of life. So, to us, that would be the rough part of going over there. But to them, that was the easiest part. The hardest part was getting there, which is just the opposite of what we would go through. We would think of going through basic training, learning English, learning to eat with a fork, this sort of thing. It was nothing. It's getting over there fighting and shooting that's the big problem.
Yes.
To them, it was just completely the opposite. Once they got older, they were back among, they were doing things that were in tune with the activities. And,
you asked me whether it was traumatic at the time or what the effect is now. Now, as the years have gone by, did it make any difference in their psychology, I guess you would call it? I mean, did it affect their lives in a...
It's affected the whole tribe. They came back here. I think more than anything else, it was the men who were rejected because they couldn't speak English and had no education. In the service, not just code talkers, the service.
Yes.
And all of a sudden it dawned on them, oh my God, for 2,000 years, Navajos have been able to fight when a war comes along. Now all of a sudden I find out that I can't fight unless I learn how to speak English and read a book. And have an education. So we're going to have an education. And the result is that when these veterans came back, I think more than any one single act, they came back and not asked for an education, but demanded it. And whereas before, and there's a line right there, 1946. Before 1946, the biggest problem of the BIA was to kidnap and round up Navajo children to force them to go to school. 1946, the problem, holding back the tide. What are you doing? We built one school, they couldn't fill it. Now all of a sudden there's enough kids to fill 10 schools and they want school right now. And it was fantastic. And your whole educational program as a result of not just the code talkers, but and as a result of these adults who now are saying, oh my God, my son, if there's ever a fight, he's going to be able to go into the service, and he's, you know, if it takes an education to make him qualified, he is going to get an education.
Now, of course, all of what we're seeing right around, even in East Lansing, where people have come back from the Vietnamese War, and, well, one, for instance, one man just sneaked up and killed a service attendant because all at once he was back on the battlefield, you know.
And then after World War II, we had after the Civil War.
Yes. Now, I know that that's true, and I wonder if, since these men had not been away from the reservation, do you think that there was more of a mental strain, more psychological?
Definitely, there was. Yeah. Ira Hayes was a good example.
What happened to Ira Hayes? I know about him.
Drowned, became an alcoholic and drowned, and for no other reason than that everybody idolized him. Here's a man that raised the flag in Iwo Jima,
yes,
and this sort of thing, and he couldn't take it. Very traumatic. And there have been Navajos that, to some extent, had a very mental problem. I think they took it probably out on alcohol more than anything else, rather than going out and shooting other people. Because that part they could contain. Actually, the biggest problem was coming back and readjusting to a nonviolent life. And which is true. I've seen after I remember after World War II cases of shell shock and,
oh, yes,
and
yes,
this sort of thing.
It's, it's general.
I remember one bad case I met of a Navajo up in Chin Lee in the early late 1950s, 58-59. Very Asiatic features. And could show you the bayonet scars in his stomach and his legs and, his, and the fingernails that still hadn't grown out because they were pulled out. He was in Korea and captured by the Chinese, not the North Koreans, but the Chinese. And because of his Asiatic features, they came to the conclusion that he was a turncoat, that he was actually of Chinese ancestry. And some of these Navajos can look pretty Oriental.
Mm-hmm.
And the more he tried to convince them that he was American Indian and not a Chinese, the less they believed him, the more they tortured him to make him confess that he was a Chinese.
Okay.
And they put him through hell. And he came back and took the drink. And I really don't
blame him. You can't blame him. You can't blame him.
But I mean, this was a situation where a lot of other veterans were obviously American, Caucasian. And he just
this had would be some escape. Well, now, this morning I asked you if you knew of any instances of their, of course, now, you didn't serve in World War II.
No.
But I just wondered if you knew of any situation in which they had any war dances or anything, other than the one that Ray Pyle wrote about. And I thought, if I knew of anything like that, it would make a very good for the children.
I don't really know. That really doesn't sound even Navajo. That sounds more like a group of Plains Indians.
I thought that he said this was Navajo,
I do remember recall reading or hearing that the there were a group of Plains Indians with this. Oh, the division that that has the Indian chief on the emblem.
The Thunderbird, you mean? Or no?
No.
Oh, I don't know.
Sure. Anyway, almost the whole division went over.
From Oklahoma.
Yeah, and they went over on D-Day, the Normandy invasion, and they were transport over gliders. They were one of the units that went over gliders and sailboats. And the day or so before, they all gave each other the Mohawks, and they dressed up in war paint, and they probably scared the Germans to death more than anything else. And they started piling out of those gliders in there. And I've seen World War II film footage showing them all with the war paint. And of course, they trimmed their hair just to the Mohawk.
Yes.
And they put on some dances and that sort of thing. But it was more just to not only build up their morale, but to build up all the other units' morale around too, just a morale booster.
They weren't Mohawks, were they?
They weren't, no. God, I can't think of the name of that. Not the Thunderbird.
I know that's men, true. I know that's
this
true.
This idea of just two men assigned to a unit, yes, and this sort of thing.
One would be on the ship, one be on with the landing party and so forth. Yes, I understand that.
And
well,
it wasn't really that.
It was.
Much. I would discredit it now, and it might not be with the code talkers. Now, you have Navajo units that were in the Army and other branches where you had whole platoons of Indians, maybe not entirely Navajo, but Indians.
Well, we'll just forget about that then.
But if you have some sources of it, I think
then you ought to be authenticated.
Yeah.
Yes.
And look into it. And I wouldn't ever say it couldn't have happened.
Yes.
Now,
I have just mentioned this. It had to do with the Navajo. A professional soldier is under no circumstance afraid. They're never afraid.
Everybody's afraid.
Well, that's, I mean, that's.
Not supposed
that
to.
Was, that this was the code. I mean, that was just the code they were to live up to. Under no circumstances should he be afraid. And I just wondered if. Well, I did read one fabulous. You can turn this off.
The story, but it. I should. I didn't want to take the quarter of the night that you was telling us all this too. But it was basically that this concept of walking artillery. With turrets behind you, and they're shooting over your head. And they're increasing their range as your unit is supposed to be advancing. And somehow the artillery got behind them, or they got into their own.
Well, one of the instances that I can acquire while I'm here from the men who actually experience it, the happier I will be. And I think Mr. Hobbs to round up the men so that I'll have a chance to talk to them while I'm here.
If you want to do it right here, I'd be willing to. I'd love to get some of it on tape myself. For
oh, that would be beautiful. I would love to do it right here. I think this would be actually the best place. I think they'd rather do that than to come to the hotel or anything.
I'd like to just, if you don't mind,
listen, you have anything that I can get.
Kick myself too. That now that I've gotten this material from him, that I haven't followed it up with some. You know, general tapes, and because Johnson stuff just goes right up to the training session.
That's what he has. Now that's what I want to fill in, because now I saw his stuff, but of course I don't have copies of it, and I must have copies of it. But that is as far, and then these things they're prepping during the whole right up to the end. Then I read today that they also were in Germany and Sicily. Now, do you know whether or not they stayed to the end of the war? Were they utilized to the end of the war?
I really think so. In almost all of your cases, these were unless casualties and a lack of replacements eliminated them.
Yes.
But they really didn't need them so much in Germany, mainly because the Germans couldn't break our standard codes.
I see.
It wasn't the fact that the Germans knew Navajo. It was that we could come up with codes fairly easily that the Germans
could
not
break.
Those Japanese were just a wizard.
Oh, they are wizards. They're just wizards anyway.
Breaking our codes. So there was more. This was really the ulterior, the ultimate situation. To get this program, the only one that the Japanese never did break. And we had quite a few codes going with the Germans. By the time they finally got around to breaking it, we changed the code. And we could keep one step ahead of them. But Johnson may have shown it to you, the article in the paper just a couple weeks ago.
Yes, he did.
Vietnam, where we overran a Vietnam position, found 1,400 of our coded messages. And he said, boy, this would have never happened if they had a couple Navajos out there.
That is going to be in my book.